Okay, so I guess we'll get started with our small group here, and I'm recording it so that the folks who couldn't be here today can hear what we're talking about. So thanks for accommodating on the off day, and sorry about my schedule last week. And I may sit down for a while today too, I don't know, we'll see how. But right now I feel good standing, so I'll stand. So we're gonna go over some more basics, and then we're gonna talk about addictive design, trying to help you with your current assignment number two. So some administrative things. So today we don't have any presentations. Actually, I think we got our three volunteers already for Wednesday, so that's great. So sign up for one other presentation during the semester on the document that we sent out. And as I note, they're very different. All the types of articles and everything are sort of a different flavor. So some of them are APKs, some of them are APIs, and some of them are research papers, and some of them are like tips for programming. And so you can pick one that's sort of, it's first come, first serve, but you can pick something that's along the lines of what you want. But no matter what it is, what we want you to do is teach us something about it. So if it's an API, you might want to try it out and see if it actually works. Don't just rely on the documentation. If it's tips, you need to figure out which ones are the most important, useful ones that the class may or may not know about. And so teach us something interesting. Okay, so assignment one, congratulations to many of you, because we know that a lot of people got it working and everything went well. And so the goal here was, if you've done it and you've completed it, you have your development environment set up, you've made a small change to some existing code, you've published an app on the Play Store, and you've got your account, you've signed it, you've updated, and you're also using Git. So that's a lot of stuff. It's good, like all those logistics are now hopefully behind you, and then as we go forward in the course, you'll just keep updating that app on the App Store. So for assignment one, you compiled and published, and so now what you see on the apps on the Play Store is all these numads with everybody's icon, which is what we want. It's not, it's not going to be something. Most of these are not something that people, desperately want to download. And then on our phones, what we see is something like this. A lot of these are from last semester, but we get unique icons with your name, and then it's sort of easy to find your apps. And again, you've done a lot of things to make this possible. So a couple things I want to highlight. Again, we want to keep it no frills on the Play Store. We don't want anything that's going to attract people to download the software. So resist the temptation to start adding stuff to that. Don't do anything. And then we want the screenshots to be, this application's not intended for public use, all that stuff. And then in the actual program, the key buttons are eventually, as we get to the end of the course, you're going to have a whole bunch of other buttons here, like this is from last semester, but you're going to keep these initial buttons that you have, you're just going to keep adding to this application. So it's one application, you just keep updating it, and the way we grade it is we just update off the store, and we get the latest application. And then in your case, you've also got a headshot photo of you in there. That's partly just to help us, partly as a learning thing so you can figure out how to do it, partly as a so we can start to learn who you all are. And then you've got, obviously, Sudoku. So one important thing is what's the create error, why the create error button? And that's because I want you to learn how to use that to your advantage to figure out what the problems are. So one of the benefits of publishing on the App Store is that Google does some work for you that allows you to track bugs, and you can get stack trace information. So if you have somebody else run it, like if we run it and we encounter an error, we're going to report the error, and then that's going to show up on the Google, on your developer console. And if you have anybody else in the class run it, or a friend of yours run it, and you report the error, it's going to show up there too. So what you want to do is every time you get an error, if we're testing your software, we're always going to report it. If we have that option. And when you report it, you can put a message. Normally, we're not going to put a message there. Occasionally, we might. But then, if you go to your Google Developer Console, so this is one for a program that I have, well, you have down here errors, okay? So you see your application and your account, and then you see errors. And what you want to do is get in the habit of checking this on a regular basis. So once a day, go here and check what these errors are. As far as I know, there's no way to get it to automatically email you. Maybe there is, but I don't believe that they have that feature. This interface that Google has, it's a lot better than it used to be a year ago, but it's got some major user interface design issues that I wish they would resolve. I don't think it's the highest thing on their priority list to do it. Like I say, it's a lot better than it was a year ago, but it still got some things. So it would be nice, for example, if you could get an email notification whenever an error popped up. But again, I don't think you can do it. So if you click on errors, what you see are freezes and crashes, and then they have old reports per week and old and new. And in this case, I have one new report. And then if I click on that new report, then what I get, I can see the stack trace. And you can also see the message that if you click on this, and if the user left you a message, like, you know, I was doing this and it crashed, right? And that's where what they fill in on this screen right here. If they fill something in there, then you're going to see that message up here if you click on this. But the most important thing is you get the stack trace. And so now you've got a stack trace that may or may not be from your phone, like a phone that you normally test on. We may be testing on a different phone. And so oftentimes the stack trace is, you know, makes it really obvious. So this is what the problem was, right? But if you don't have, you know, you want to try to take advantage of this. So we will, when we get an error, we'll report it. But you know, if you have friends with Android phones or something, beg them to install it on their phone and just kind of keep it running. Because once we get to the point where, right now your app doesn't do anything, it just sits there when nobody's using it. But eventually you're going to have apps that are running services in the background and that are doing things on a periodic basis. They're responding to location changes or other stuff like that. And that's when this will become really important, because it's hard to test this stuff. And if you just let it run on somebody's phone, after a while, you know, you'll start getting bugs that you otherwise wouldn't have seen. So the other thing we wanted you to do is the version control software. And I know some of you are thinking, this is really a pain. Why do we have to do this Git stuff and Bitbucket stuff? And the reason is because I'm trying to help you learn what is, in the long run, a good practice for you. So in the short run, it seems like a pain in the neck and extra work. Why do I have to do this? But in the long run, using version control is going to make you a better software developer, and it's going to help you in this course, even if you're working by yourself without a partner. So there's several good systems out there. SVN, Git, and Mercurial are three of them. There's sort of religious wars about which ones are better among developers. For basic versioning, any of them are really OK. The reason that we picked Git, I actually think SVN is sort of conceptually simpler. Git is probably more powerful, but kind of more confusing. But the reason we picked Git is because on Bitbucket, you as students can get a free account, and it's private. So you can get a private free account. So GitHub, another one, is kind of sort of Bitbucket's competitor, I guess. GitHub, I'm not sure if you can have a private account or not, but on Bitbucket you can, and we could set it up so we can have access to it and you can have access to it. So anyway, that's why we picked it. But they're all mostly the same, and then there's articles on the syllabus that sort of go into conceptually how they operate. If you feel like you don't really understand what you're doing, you probably want to read those articles so that you understand what's the difference between a pull and a commit and a push and, you know, the sort of the terminology. But once you get in the habit of doing it, it's providing you with a code backup, a code change history. You can easily share your work with other people and simultaneously work on essentially the same code base. And it's a good incentive to document what you do. So when you make a change, you're just documenting that change. So what I don't want you to do, what I don't want you to do is what many people last semester did, which is they didn't bother with Git or Bitbucket until the night before the assignment was due, and then they basically pushed everything to Bitbucket, and then oftentimes they didn't know what they had problems at that point, and you know, things weren't set up right. So they didn't really know what they were doing. They were just kind of going through the motions because I asked them to. What you really want to do is when you're working on your code on your computer, and you make something that you consider, you know, any reasonable kind of fix or improvement, you want to go ahead and commit the code locally, or push the code locally essentially to your own Git repository that's sitting on your computer, and then ultimately push it to Bitbucket, so that you're not just waiting until an assignment's due, you're constantly putting the code on there as you work on it. And the reason that's valuable is because if your computer crashes or, you know, anything like that, you're going to have a remote repository on Bitbucket that's going to have all your most recent code. And the beauty of this is even if you make a catastrophic mistake, right? You start programming something and you know, you've been working on it for half a day, and at the end of it, you decide this was not a good idea. I need to scrap what I was doing. I want to go back to what I was doing before. This gives you the ability to go back to what you had before. And when you learn how to do it, when you read those documents and they tell you how to do it, you become less afraid of making changes because you know that you can always go back to what you had before. It's not like, you know, otherwise what you end up doing is you make copies of a directory and you say, here's a copy and it works, now I'm going to change it in case I mess it up. And you don't really want to do that. That's not a good coding practice, okay? So I'm going to be off my soapbox at this point in terms of this. All we're going to do is be checking that you use it. But what I want to see is that I really do want to see commits on a regular basis on Bitbucket, not just a commit before every assignment is due. Okay? And I, for those of you who use this already, I already know that, because usually once people start doing this, they say, how did I ever work before I did this? You go to any company, you're going to have to use, you know, systems like this. But until you do it, it seems like it's just kind of like, why am I doing this? It's not adding anything. I'm not getting anything. But just do it, and trust me, by the end of the course, you'll say, this, I understand this now, and you'll just use it in your future work no matter what you do. Okay. The other thing is that Bitbucket is nice because it gives you a bug and issue tracker, a feature tracker. And these are also nice because it's just a single place where you can prioritize bugs and feature requests. And actually what I like about Bitbuckets is that it's pretty straightforward. Some of them have, you know, about 20, 30, every time you enter a bug or a feature request, there's about 20 or 30 different things that you can fill out and prioritize and all these different categories of stuff. And that's nice if you're getting complicated, but Bitbuckets is actually very straightforward. There's just like four or five things that you enter, the priority, who's kind of responsible for fixing it, which most of the time would be you, but once you have a partner, it might be your partner. And then you can see everything, and then when you make a change, you can keep updating it, and then when you fix something, you can say fixed, and it sort of gets off your list. So you have a nice prioritized list, and that's useful for you. And actually, I thought about, I'm not sure we would do it, but you know, we can actually report bugs to you too through that if we want to. We could go there and make an issue and say, the thing crashed, here's an issue, right? I don't know that we're going to do that in this case, but you and your partner and your team could certainly do that. And it will help you out if you do it. So I would encourage you to use this as well as a way to store your to-do list in terms of what you have to fix as your projects get more complicated. Here's what it looks like for one project that we have. So it's just a list of issues, and you can see the status and who's assigned to it and when it was created, and there's a priority, and so you can rank order them and all that. And if you click on one, then you get more information about it. Okay, so a couple observations based on the assignments that were turned in for number one. So first was, I wanted to make a comment on the fact it's an individual assignment. And so just so everybody's clear, I wanted to talk for a moment about what's acceptable in terms of collaborating on individual assignments. So what I want you to do is talk to other people, you know, have conversations about how to do things, how to write code. What I don't want you to do is be copying blocks of code from other people, okay? Whether that's people in the class or people outside of the class. And so that is not acceptable. So what you don't want to do is get yourself in the position, which has happened in the past, where two people essentially turn in code and it's essentially identical code, okay? That's not acceptable. Even if you were sitting right next to each other on the computer, you know, sometimes people say we were sitting right next to each other and we were typing identical, you know, this stuff into the computer. Well, you know, it didn't pass the common sense test in terms of, you know, what people were doing. So don't put yourself in that position. That's one reason why we don't want you to put your code on a public repository as well, like GitHub. We want it to be private, so only you and then ultimately your partner have access to it. We don't want to see, you know, duplicate code turned in. So it's perfectly fine to discuss with each other, you know, what are you doing, what's a good strategy for doing this, that sort of thing. You know, sharing links to tutorials and stuff is perfectly fine. But, you know, copying big chunks of code from other people and even copying chunks of code and making, you know, minor naming changes, that's not acceptable, okay? So if you have any doubts whatsoever about whether something's acceptable or not, before you do it, come to me, because if we do see any issue with it, you know, even if you didn't do it, somebody else did it and took what you had, you're both responsible in that case. Okay? So Any questions on that? All right, so some other observations here. We got a lot of good things. You know, you did, people seem to be able to deal with the icons. There were some nice design changes, like backgrounds, title stylization. Some people changed the background music, fading splash screens. There were good nods to thinking about design even on simple screens, which is what I want you to do. So people had back buttons, very clear formatting, alignment, large fonts, very different, you know, so people were thinking about what they were doing even on simple stuff. What you really want to do is refactor and change the package names in Sudoku. There were some issues about people not naming the app properly. There's sort of various names of the app in the title bar versus the app on the launcher. So watch out for that type of stuff. Some people didn't prevent the operation of unauthorized phones using the code we provide, which is important logistically, but also we just wanted you to learn how to incorporate that code. And that should stay in there the entire course, that code. And then making your own icon for the launcher, most people are able to do that, and then using the Husky for the Play Store, most people sort of followed those instructions and did that right. So if you still have the Sudoku music, on your home screen, please remove it because it gets old after a while listening to it. A big issue a bunch of people had was you need always to assume that an orientation change is possible. So some people forgot about this, and then when you rotate the phone or you rotate the emulator, it either crashes altogether or the formatting makes the app unusable. So you can prevent this with an Android on-screen orientation equals portrait in your manifest if you want. And sometimes that's appropriate and sometimes that's not. It ultimately depends on your application. But it's better to do this design for the portrait than it is to have it crash. Like what you don't want it to do is crash, right? So make a deliberate decision. And even if you're only using the emulator, I don't remember, do you remember the command off the top of your head? There's a command to control F. F11, okay, so control F11 will swap between the two modes. And we'll talk in a second about an issue related to this later today. So formatting, so small things make a difference in the perception of what you do. And this is, I'm gonna harp on this the whole class, okay? Because what I see a lot of is students come into me and they show me class projects. And sometimes the class projects are really nice, but there's just some stuff in there that's like sloppy. It looks sloppy. And so they may have done a huge amount of work, and then they have this sort of sloppiness. And then you go, well, why didn't they? I want a detail-oriented person. I want to hire a detail-oriented person. And if they have text and they didn't even bother to like left align it, right, or make it just like make something line up right, if they didn't bother to do that, yeah, you know, they did a lot of work on the rest of this application, but can I trust that they're really somebody who's going to think about all the little details, right? So I'm going to, you know, I'm not asking for fancy design. All I'm asking for is clarity or cleanness in what you do. So try to, you know, make things align, like left align, or don't have like a bunch of stuff where it just looks like you just kind of put it on the screen and then, you know, okay, it's on the screen, I don't have to worry about it now. If you have a bunch of buttons, make them align, or make them, don't make like five different buttons all the same size, just make them the same size if it looks a little bit nicer that way. So simple things like that, not having typos, a single typo, it impacts your credibility with anybody that you show something to. You might think it's just a typo, but it's not, because it means you either didn't catch it or didn't try to catch it, or you didn't care, and the person doesn't know. And so just try to do things like that. Avoid, you know, really hard to read colors, like red on a blue background, for example, is a very jarring sort of type of thing, hard to read. We'll talk a little bit about this in the class. This is not a class about design, It's one thing to be a skilled designer. That's hard, and that takes a lot of training and practice. But just knowing a few little things about design, you can sort of up your credibility quite substantially. And we're gonna try to point those things out where possible, so that you end up with better applications at the end of the day. And it's nice to offer a quit button. This will come up a couple times in the class at various points, but Android has a back button. it was probably a bad decision to make the back button that hardware button in the way that they did. It's confusing because now you never know, am I supposed to press the back button or not? Like, how does the back button function in an application in Android is somewhat confusing. I think it was a very poor user interface decision that they made. So it's nice if you offer a quit or a back button yourself in your application so that it's crystal clear to the user what they have to do. Okay, and I guarantee you that if you do that and it's clear, they'll always end up pressing your button. They only press the hardware buttons usually as a last resort because they don't really know what they should be pressing on Android anyway. And so then they say, I don't know what to press, so I guess I'll press the back button and see if that works. And that's not good user interface design if they're kind of guessing what they should do. Okay, a couple other things. So the version name, there's two things here. There's the code, which is what the Play Store cares about. So you probably figured out that if you want to update your app, you have to keep increasing the version, the code, by one every time. Okay, and that's where you, I'll come back to it in a second, but that's where you activate your APK. But then there's this version number, which is what people actually see. And so you need to have some system that you use that keeps these in sync. What I do is just kind of go one, or on the version number, I have like 100 here, and then I'll do 101 on here, and then that'll be 1.01 here, but that's just my system. So they're very systems people use for keeping track of these. These are two independent things, but this one always has to go up every time you do a new release on the store. So a thing that I don't think I put here that I want to mention now, so on the store, there's a user interface sort of conceptual bug, which is that when you upload a new APK, it puts the APK there, and then you'll see that you'll have your old APK and the new APK. And then it says activate the new APK, okay? And then you can activate the new APK. But then you also, there's a button up in the top right-hand corner that says save. If you don't hit save, you haven't actually activated the new APK. So I've done this numerous times, and people in the class prior, like, this happens all the time because it's not obvious in terms of your user interface. You think when you hit activate, you actually activated it, but you didn't. You only activate it if you hit activate and then you hit save. So what I would recommend that you do as a best practice is when you upload a new version of your app to the Play Store, which you'll be doing on a regular basis, right? And you don't have to wait until, you know, just before an assignment's due, that, you know, you can upload whenever you want. But when you upload, you need to go back to your main developer console screen. Go back to this one and make sure that this is the version number that you think it should be. Okay? Because what happens is when you go in here, I don't have it right here. When you click on this thing and you go in, if we have time later, I can do it. If anybody's not clear, I want to do it. But what I'm talking about, when you click on this, it'll go in, and then you can change the info about your program, and then you can also upload a new APK. Upload a new APK, and then it'll show your old APK version and your new APK version. And there's a button that says activate the new version. You click on that, but you have to remember to hit save, okay? Because otherwise it's not activated. So go back here and just double check that this says what you think it should be. Then, for whatever reason, it usually takes several hours before this actually hits the Play Store. So now you've updated it, but it won't be available on the Play Store for a couple hours. Sometimes it's less, sometimes it's more. I don't know, it's pretty random. It's propagating somewhere in Google's, you know, infrastructure. So I'm not sure exactly what's going on there. But so it takes a little while before it's actually available. Okay. All right, always make sure you only have one icon that's showing up on the phone after the app install. We don't want new activities showing up in the launcher. And Git, you want to organize your packages clearly. You know, a little bit of time spent organizing your code is going to make your life easier generally on any coding. And then again, push and commit regularly. And then finally, okay, passwords. I said in the first class or two, don't lose your passwords, and already people have lost passwords. So whatever it takes, you know, like tattooing it on your forehead is probably not the best idea, but figure out a way to not lose those passwords and those keys, because once you do it, you're done for. You cannot have a duplicate package name on the store. There's one unique package name on the whole Play Store. So once you use it, if you lose it, it's gone, okay? All right, anybody have any questions or observations from the first assignment? Yeah.
When I was out with my APK to Google Play Store, the app's name will automatically load my manifest file and load the version name.
Yes.
As its default name. So, but it provides no functionality for me to revise it. So my app showing the AU med plus my name and bracket. With the version name, with the version name I added in the manifest file, so it will display all the string, this string.
In the Play Store listing?
Yeah.
I don't know. You might want to talk with Mansoor. I'm not sure what that is. So you might want to talk with Mansoor about that. I don't know why that's happening. In the Play Store, it should show up, you know, as a normal listing based on the information that's shown in your, you know, in the developer console where you're entering the information. What is the name of the application is independent of as it shows up on the Play Store, that's independent of the information that's in the manifest. So it's the Play Store, you know, you're kind of defining a bunch of stuff, and that's how it shows up when people search for it. And then there's how it shows up on the phone is determined by what's in the manifest. And they're mostly independent. Okay? Anything else? Yeah.
So we said that we do have just one package with the name, NAU.edu and our name.
Right.
So when we turn into next assignment, so everything, all Java files will be under the same package, right?
Yes.
So is it like,
No. No. So you should have your main package and then within that and then you have sub packages within the main package. Okay? So that's why I was saying you want to refactor Sudoku, for example, so that it's your, and I think the assignment says this, it's your main package with your name, you know, your whatever .edu, .all thing in your name, and then it's slash, and then you can keep going, right? So the one that's on the App Store is your main package name, and then you've got subdirectories in there essentially, which are extensions to the package. And so then you can have Sudoku, you can have all your other assignments, right? When we do Boggle, and that's why it's important that you put each assignment in a separate directory structure within your code base. But you're not uploading anything at this point. You have one application on the store, and you just keep updating it. Okay, and you're going to add buttons to the main screen. And by the end of the course, you're going to have everything from this first assignment, which is just your main screen, but you've got your team button and all that. That'll stay there. The next assignment, you're going to add a Boggle button. By the end of the course, you're going to have your final project, but it stays the same the whole time. It's the same application. And in fact, on our phones, we'll just set it so that it auto-updates. And then when you do an update, it updates on our phone. And in fact, an important thing about that is that if you turn in your assignment and you know the next day you realize, oops, there's a bug because maybe it showed up on the bug tracker or you saw it or whatever, you can update whenever you want. So we grade what's there when we get to grading it. Okay, so if it's not there when we look for it, when we're grading it, then you know that's a problem and it's going to be counted late. But if you update it and it got updated before we have a chance to get to it, then you know you fixed a problem before we saw it. So you know, do you want to think of it as we're your customer and you released your app, right? And oh, you found a bug, update, right? Fix it. don't just say it's not just stuck there, just fix it. And we'll, before we grade it, we'll always make sure we have the most recent version. So Okay. All right. So let's see. Well, one other thing I wanted to mention was the project structure in Eclipse. Some of you probably had things like building and syncing bugs. You might have had some linkages between your code and your resources may have been kind of funny. Forgetting to put information in the manifest and typos. These things are very common. You're going to have them all throughout the course. So you want to, you know, develop strategies where you start figuring out, this is what I have to figure out. You know, this is where I could have a problem right now. Because these things can, you know, suck up a lot of time if you're not real careful. So you want to be well rested when you program too, because those things are really easy to miss. Okay. Did any of you have any tips or tricks from Eclipse or anything that like logistically when you did this jumped out at you that you wish you had known about the environment? No, okay. All right, so if you, as you come across them in the course, post them on Piazza and help other people out. So the grades for these, there were 21 possible points, I think. Did you send out all the ones we could? Okay, so Mansour sent out all the ones we could. A bunch of people haven't turned things in and we're trying to figure out what the status is. So if that's you, you need to contact Mansour and let him know what's actually going on with your app. If you fix something right now, by Wednesday morning, essentially, it would be considered still late and you'd be get your one grade off. If you can't fix it by then, you can use the revise and resubmit pass later if you want. But this by, you know, all means is an easy getting starting assignment. So you want to get this one turned in and finished if you don't have it done. Okay, so now we have a sort of a mishmash of things to talk about here today. So first, I want some more logistics, sort of important things to emphasize or reemphasize. So again, I mentioned last time I was here two key things. One is that when you write code in Android, the operating system is on your case. It wants you to do it right. And so if you write something that doesn't respond to a user action like a button, within 5 seconds, you're going to get the ANR, application not responding message. Or if you have a broadcast receiver, which you probably don't have yet, if that doesn't return within 10 seconds, you're going to get this message. But that's all worst case, not your goal. So I just want to reemphasize that if you're writing code that's too slow or problematic, you're going to get this sort of message. This is going to be one of the most frequent sort of errors you're going to get throughout the course. And it means, if you get this error, it means something's wrong. with some way that you've structured something, something's probably wrong. All right, so there's this activity lifestyle, and I just want to go over this because it's confusing at first, I think. So the activity lifestyle in Android, it relates to this. It relates to this issue here, okay, the application not responding. So an activity starts, and then there's a variety of phases that it can go through. And then it gets to the point where it's running, and then at some point it's ultimately shut down, okay? So between starting, running, and shut down, it's got a number of phases that are important to understand. There's something called onCreate, onStart, and onResume. So these are three methods that are within an activity that are going that you can overwrite and put code in. So you can put code in these to do something specifically that has to happen between the time you start the activity and the time that the thing is running. And then if the activity stops running, there are three important methods, onPause, onStop, and onDestroy, where you can also put code to do important things before the thing completely goes away. So as we talked about before, I believe, so in Android, you don't really have complete control over what's happening with your application. If somebody's using your application and a phone call comes in, the phone call application is going to take over the screen. And your application is pushed into the background. But not only is it pushed into the background, it might be shut down entirely. So it's at the operating system's discretion that it's going to shut your code down. Okay? So I emphasized this before, but I'm going to keep reemphasizing it because this is where you're going to get into sort of conceptual problems as you think about code. At any moment in time, Android can shut down your code. So you must plan accordingly. Okay? And these are the functions that are going to, or methods that are going to give you that ability. So the first thing is when I start an activity, I have to initialize all my data structures, get everything set up, right? Now, sometimes that's going to take a really long time. If I have to load in, let's say in your Boggle assignment, you have to load in a really big, long list of words, okay? That could take a long time. you don't want to do that every single time. You only want to do that when you really need to. So if your application is in the foreground and a phone call comes in, and then the phone call goes away, you don't necessarily want to reload all the words if it's thousands of words, right? You only want to load them if you have to reload them. Now, Android might force you to because it might have killed your program. And then when the phone call goes away, it restarts your program again. And so then you have to reload them, right? But you need the right code in the right place in order to do the right stuff at the right time. okay, based on what the operating system is doing. So this is different than coding on a PC where you usually don't have to worry about any of this stuff, okay? In your case, you always have to be thinking, how can the operating system hurt me, and how do I get my code in the right place to so that it's gonna work properly? So what we have, onCreate is the type of thing that's hardly ever gonna happen. This is like the very first time that starts this activity, and most of the time your activity is gonna sit there in memory, and it's gonna be in the background just sitting in memory dormant. And so if you do something that's computationally intensive, and you only have to do it once, you probably want to do it in onCreate. There's something called onStart, and the difference between these two is a little bit confusing, okay? And I'll get to that in a second. So the thing to keep in mind is you have states. So your application can be stopped, which is completely obscured, but it retains its state, but sometimes it's killed. And it can be paused, which means it lost focus, but it's visible, sort of transparent, and it retains its state. So in many of your cases, when you popped up you have your main activity, and then you popped up another window, which is like a transparent little window that has your name and your info in it, right? That one's on top of your initial activity, and you can see your initial activity behind it. Okay, what that means is that your initial activity is paused. Your initial activity is paused. It's not stopped. So if it's completely not visible, it's probably stopped. If it's visible but you can't interact with it, it's paused. And if you're interacting with it, it's actually active. Okay? And so depending on which of those states that it's in, then that determines which of these things get run. So when you start an activity, it goes through onCreate. You want to do all the really kind of time-intensive stuff there to a certain extent. With some caveats, and then it goes to onStart, and then it goes to onResume, and then it's running. Now, if some other piece of code comes in, it can pause my application, so now my application can be paused, but I can be in the background. So if I pop up another little window in front of my window, like many of you did with your name and email information, then this one is paused. But it's still active, but it's not in the foreground. Okay, so in this case, it would go through on pause, and it would go to on stop. It would run on stop, and then it would stop. Then when you dismiss the window that's on top, then it's going to go back here to on restart, to on start, on resume, and then it's going to show up again. Whereas So what you essentially want to do is, you can think of it as putting the most time-intensive stuff here, and the stuff that any time your screen goes away and comes back again, you probably want to put here. Because you're going to have to update it in case something changed. So it's not like you can draw the screen and then assume that everything's always up to date again, because it could be that a phone call came in and your app went away, and now a phone call goes away and your app comes back again, and you may need to update something. So this is a very important diagram. and what's really important about it is that if your activity starts and your activity is running, most of the time, if a phone call comes in or something else happens, you're going to be looping around here. But occasionally, Android will say, I need more memory. So just kill their app. And then you'll go down through here, on, stop, on, destroy, and now you're gone. And now the other app goes away. And Android says, oops, OK, I got to restart the app, because now my other app that was consuming all these resources went away. And so then it's going to come back up here and go through onCreate again. Okay? So this is why it's complicated. You can't assume that it's only going to run onCreate once. But you can't assume. So most of the time, it'll run onCreate, and then the process will just sit in the background. And you might be working with it for days or weeks and never have a bug. And then somebody else downloads it onto their phone, and they've got all this CPU-intensive software on there. And now, every time their software runs, your software gets killed. And so suddenly, your software is going through onCreate all the time, whereas before, it was hardly ever doing it. These are the issues you have to be aware of as you work on Android. Okay, vast majority of problems that you have as you start using services and stuff are going to come because you get applications not responding errors are going to come because you've got some part of this code in here that's doing the wrong thing at the wrong time. It's taking too much time. Okay, so I'll give you an example. So you're creating a Boggle game, okay, and the Boggle game's got a very long list of words. It's a megabyte or something. It's 2 megabytes. It's a big long list of words you're going to work with. If you have code in here that's reading in this big long list of words and doing a lot of really complicated processing, it might take you more than 5 seconds on the phone to process that, okay, before something's going to happen. So what'll happen in Android is they'll click on your button, there'll be kind of a black screen, it'll sit there, and after 5 seconds, you're just processing words, right? Trying to get it so that they can play Boggle, but they'll get this message. Okay? So what you need to do is offload that cleverly so that it's not blocking your main user interface thread, so that the user can still interact with your application, but the word processing might have to be going on in a different thread off in the background. Okay? But you cannot block the user interface thread for the activity by doing a whole bunch of processing right here. That's going to be a problem. Even though you only have to do it really, you don't have to do it very often, most of the time, because Android won't kill your application most of the time. But some of the time it will, so some of the time it'll go back and redo this again. And then you have to think, well, gosh, is it okay if it redoes this after a phone call? Is it going to be okay if it has to run all this code before they get back to the Boggle game? Or do I need it to be that their phone call ends and the Boggle game is right back where it was before? And that's what you want it to do, right? So now you're going to have to think really carefully. If my whole application gets killed by Android, how do I get it so that the Boggle game comes right back the way it was before? And that's what you'll have to be thinking about as you do this. Okay? So study this diagram very carefully. It's an important diagram. And there's so many states, because to get that to work properly, where the app is always coming back rapidly and it's responsive, means you have to put the right stuff in the right place . So a good example I found from the web was, if you think about like a drive to work activity and the things you'd have to do. So in the onCreate, you're going to do things that you have to do sort of once at the very beginning. In the onStart, you're going to do things that you might do more than once, but not as often as this. In the onResume, these are things that you're doing constantly, right? Apply footbrake, release handbrake. Then in the onPause, again, now I'm stopping driving. So I'm rapidly switching between onResume, when I drive a car, and onPause. I'm constantly going back and forth between these two things, but I'm not rapidly going back and forth between what happens at sort of the beginning and the end, right? And sort of the enter the office building, for example. So this is a totally obviously sort of contrived example, but it's worth spending a little time studying it to see, like, on restart, where would that be versus just on start in the first place. Again, sort of totally conceptual, but that the idea is you need to get the parts that people do a lot in the on pause and on resume or as close to that as possible, but they have to be very, very fast. Get the parts that you do not so often in the on create or the earlier part, but even that has to be fast. So that's where you get into tricky issues. All right, so then again, the states, you've got a lifetime, which is going from onCreate to onDestroy. Okay, so this is setting up global state, and this is generally releasing major resources. Visible lifetime, again, think of it as sort of behind a glass door. I can still kind of see my screen, but I'm not interacting with it. I'm interacting with some dialog box or something that's in front of it. And so that's onStart and onStop. A thing you'll do a lot there is registering broadcast receivers, which is the equivalent of an event handler. So when you want to do things like read sensor data, you're going to start them up whenever your app needs to be running. So even though you popped up a dialog box, you still want your receivers, you still want to be receiving sensor data, for example. And so that would be a case where you might put them in on start and on stop. Then in the foreground is the on resume, on pause. This is where you're going back and forth very rapidly, could be going back and forth very rapidly. And that should be very lightweight code. So here's your activity, here's all your functions, and typically you're going to overwrite some or all of those. Okay. Again, there's a description. This is the one for Honeycomb. Again, it's worth kind of reading through this because it's confusing until you sort of get the hang of it. And you definitely got to get the right stuff in the right place. Okay. So some implications on UI navigation. The back button you want to think about whether or not you're using the hardware back button versus the UI back button, because if you're when you have a back or a quit, you're explicitly forcing an activity to sort of go through some of these states, the hardware button is effectively going to do the same thing in many cases, but you may not always have quite as much control on exactly what's happening if you rely on the hardware button. So I would actually argue your UI should always have backs clearly built in. Saving state at all times is critical. You have to be aware of the process assassin, okay? So at any time, your stuff could get killed, so whatever information you depend upon has to be saved. And then time passing has to be considered too, by on resume, for example. So if you've displayed a screen, like the state of data on the internet, for example, and then they go off and they're on the phone for an hour, and then they get off the phone, and then your application comes back again, it may be that the information that you displayed previously is completely out of date, but it may not have gone through on create. So you can't just, let's say you're gathering data from the internet, okay, and you're displaying it in your application. You're gonna if you put it in on create and it goes off to the internet and it gathers all this information, and then it's displaying it. Now I get a phone call and I'm on the phone for an hour, and then I get off the phone call and the app comes right back to where it was before. It may not run on create. And so then you may have completely out of date information on the screen, okay? Because you assumed that on create would run sometime close to when the application actually popped up, and that's not necessarily true, okay? Okay, so let's see, where are we here? So those are some things I wanted to highlight in terms of the coding to sort of, again, get you thinking in the Android way to try to have you avoiding problems before they become problems if you're kind of thinking about how you structure your code a little bit. Now I want to move on a little bit to assignment two, and this idea of coming up with ideas for your final project. So the assignment, hopefully at this point everybody's read this carefully. It's online. The basic gist of this is we're going to analyze an addictive game, and then you're going to do a structured brainstorming exercise. Okay, so the goal here is essentially you want to review the project topic list, and then you're going to generate as many ideas as you can. So the purpose of this assignment is to help you generate ideas. And then the third assignment, actually, you'll be taking one of the best ideas and storyboarding that out a little bit. It doesn't mean it's going to be your final project. In fact, for many of you, it probably won't. It's still going to be too premature, but you're trying to flesh out one of the better ideas. And then finally, the fourth assignment, which you should be starting now, so I want to mention it now, is the Boggle assignment. And this is a very steep learning curve from the first programming assignment, okay? So there's a fairly long period of time between the one you just turned in and this one, but start this one now. Just because it's assignment four doesn't mean that you shouldn't be starting this now. You need to start this now. You're essentially doing this in parallel, reading the book, the relevant chapters of the book, and everything that you need. And you know, the classes will be getting into some of stuff like 2D graphics and stuff that help you with this, but you want to start this now. So please, you know, read it carefully and try to start it now. Many people find it a very difficult one to do. Okay, so that's kind of where we're at. So I'm going to come back to assignment two, though, and sort of where we're at in terms of coming up with design. So good advice from the Android website is sort of the big creative vision. What makes a good mobile app? You want to enchant me, simplify my life, make me amazing. Okay, these are three things that they put on their website. And I think there's a good ways to think about what's a really great app going to do. It's probably going to do one of these three things. Okay, help me do something I couldn't otherwise do, make my life simpler so I have more time to spend doing other things I want to do, or just do something enchanting, something fascinating, something I really, really enjoy. So enchanting, what do they mean? You want to delight somebody, make something effortless, have a sense of a powerful force, subtle effects, manipulate real objects versus buttons, let people make this app their own, let them customize it, let an app get to know the people and simplify the app based on those people. These are good qualities that you want to have when you come up with ideas. Simplify, so you want to keep it brief. You want, pictures are faster than words, so you want things to be visual if they can. Decide on things, but give the user the final say. Make it easy for them to decide what they need to do. Only show what's needed when it's needed. Make easy navigation. Don't lose information. Looks, if it looks the same, it should act the same. And only interrupt people if it's really important. Okay? These are high-level qualities, but they apply to many of the great applications that are the ones that really take off, right? That become really popular. Amaze. So you want things that are consistent across different applications. Gentle in prompting about errors. Encouraging. Structured with small step-by-step tasks. You want feedback on all actions, even small ones. Complex tasks should be easily completed. And important things should be completed fast. Okay. So you may be listening to this and say, well, okay, that's all totally obvious, right? Well, it might be obvious, but it's not. Once you start designing an application, if you then go back and compare this list against what you design, you may find that you're not living up to these standards, okay? So assignment two is trying to help you get to the point where we're starting to meet some of these standards. These are, you know, and these are ones laid out by Google, but they're just, you know, generally good design. So different phones have different sort of models of the way that they interact. You know, in the Android model, we've got a wallpaper sort of home screen that we can manipulate. We've got the app list similar to the way you have in iOS. You've got various ways of sort of other ways of scrolling through running applications, widgets and stuff that you can put on the home screen here. And then we have these hardware buttons, a limited number of hardware buttons, which are to some extent confusing, particularly the back button. I don't think they should have done it that way, right? So you're working within the constraint of what they've given you here. But for the most part, regardless of which of these you're designing for, you can try to hit these big high-level things of what makes an app really great. You can build a great app on Android. You can build a great app on iOS. You can build a great app in Windows Mobile too. So I think I may have had this slide in a previous set, but I'll reemphasize it here. So some of the key design challenges: we have short, bursty interactions. The user has incredible expectations for simplicity. They're going to get interrupted all the time. So that example we were just talking about: you're in the middle of something, you get an hour-long phone call, and now you're back to the app. What happens? Your design of your app probably needs to take into account that an hour has passed. In most cases, it needs to take that into account. Sometimes it may not, but oftentimes it does, right? So if I'm playing Words with Friends and an hour went by, something may have changed. So my code, my app, my design needs to take it into account, and my code probably also needs to take it into account. You have a limited input modality, so you guys can type a lot faster than me, but everybody's typing a lot slower than we want. Data reliability, our wireless access may not be that good. Standing out in a crowd is really hard. Aggressive operating systems, and then security and privacy, and then again, cost of data transmission, you got to keep that in mind too. All right, so why do I have a thing about addictive games here in this class at the very beginning? The reason is because in terms of app usage patterns, what do we have? We have competition from other apps. They're used in the midst of everyday life, and people have short attention spans, so they're going to move on to other apps. So we want to build applications, even if they're not games, that are sort of addictive, have the addictive quality of the best little games that are out there. And so it's a good exercise to start with some of those games and try to think about, how do I create something new that has some of those same properties? And so good games activate intrinsic rewards that reinforce the use of the app. That's why people start playing and they play, you know, they keep playing, right? They keep doing this because it's doing something for them that they really like and they really appreciate. And the apps that you create, you want them to have that principle, okay? So has anybody here not played Angry Birds? Okay, so that in itself is amazing, right? That you've all played Angry Birds. Now, Angry Birds, it's an outlier, okay? It's a success story. Not every, you know, there are not that many Angry Birds or things like Angry Birds. But Angry Birds, you know, it's not just because don't write it off and say that Angry Birds is just like a fluke, okay? Angry Birds became Angry Birds the way that we know it, in terms of everybody in the world knowing what it is practically with a phone, because it's got many properties that make it an outstanding user interface. And so what you want to do is understand at a theoretical level sort of what is it that makes it good, and try to build that stuff into the things that you build, okay? Last semester, I got really, you know, somewhat annoyed, because there were some students in the class who said, in a discussion on our message board, they were saying, we're not designers, we just want to learn how to code. And I pointed this out in the first and second class, okay? That you know, this is a programming class, you're learning to code, but this is a class about learning how to build mobile apps, okay? The whole experience. Because if all you know how to do is code, you're going to hit a ceiling in your career. You have to be able to at least understand how to get beyond that and see, you know, how to take a good idea and not be stuck where you can only code it. You can't take the good idea and actually make it really work as a good idea, where it's not only good code, but it also has some aspect of, you know, thinking carefully about how it fits into everyday life. And with mobile app development, you cannot separate user experience from the running of your code and the actual user interface experience. So I want you all to feel like you're empowered to be able to come up with good ideas. Somebody said, you know, we can't come up with good ideas. You know, we need designers to come up with good ideas, essentially. And I absolutely outright reject that. Okay, you are all capable of coming up with good ideas, apps that are enormously popular, but you won't do it unless you expend effort doing it. Okay, it takes effort to come up with good ideas, and that's what a design assignment 2 is about. So Angry Birds has over, it depends on who you ask, but you know, like millions and millions, hundreds of millions of downloads, definitely like 30, 40 million at least paid downloads, I think even just off the Apple Store. And so, you know, people are playing this for enormous amounts of time. Why? We want to understand why. Because you want to build apps that people find as addictive, as appealing. So what are the secrets of success? So you could say three things probably at the highest level. Addictive gameplay, a sort of a comic and humorous style, which feeds into that. And the low cost also helps. We'll talk about this, you know, throughout the course in terms of how the industry is changing and how you make money and all that. But really what I want to focus on is the addictive gameplay. Why is it good? And so this gets to the article that I'm hoping you all read. And one thing I have to mention on the reading is I'm assuming in class, sometimes I will review things that are in the reading to try to emphasize important stuff, but I'm assuming that you read the stuff that's in the syllabus. And I know so far that many people haven't read all the stuff in the syllabus, because I know that I had a mistake on Blackboard where it wasn't available on Blackboard. So people couldn't have read it unless you were really ingenious and found it. So I am assuming you read that stuff. If you don't read that stuff and you turn in assignments and you're getting it back, and you know, sometimes I'm gonna assume that you've read that and absorbed it. And if a lot of times assignments may show that you haven't. And so you just because we don't talk about it in class doesn't mean it's not important. I try to pick readings that are good. I try to highlight the most important stuff you need to read and when you need to read it. But you know, I try to pick articles that are interesting ones. And so I need you to read that material. And just because I'm not going over it in class, or just because there's not a quiz or whatever in class about that material, you know, you need to read it. I had, you know, in fact, I mean, last semester I had people who said, you know, they didn't want me to talk about any material that was in the readings at all, because they, you know, the assumption was that they had read the material. But I know what I try to do is highlight what I think are the most important things I want you to take away from that material. So there's some overlap, but not everything. I can't cover everything in the reading. Okay, so one of the readings for this week is the Angry Birds article, which you have to read for your assignment for sure. So I just want to talk about some of the things that are mentioned in this article. So what is the benefit of having more than one type of bird in Angry Birds? Right. So in what way does it do that? Yeah.
I think the there are two things that they keep changing from one level to the other is the structure of the building dedicated to grass. And the second thing is that when you see a new type of bird, people get tempted to, I want to see how it works.
Yeah.
So that factor actually makes them play their level. And if it was completely different than the type of birds that they have already played with, then that stimulates their creativity that, you know, I can use it in different ways to grass.
Right.
Right.
So we've got novelty. We've got the fact that adding birds adds cognitive complexity to the game, right? But they do it in a really clever way, which is that the game starts with a single, very simple bird, right? And then they build up one bird at a time. And what they're doing is they're teaching you, or they're letting you, even better, they're letting you learn on your own how this works in a way that's actually quite fun. But it gets increasingly cognitively challenging as they do it. Okay, so you know there are a zillion little games, catapult sort of games where you lob stuff off. There's nothing new about that, right? Those have been around forever. Angry Birds is essentially a catapult game. But Angry Birds, the fact that they added separate birds that have slightly separate functionality, it's small changes to existing ideas is what makes this game a great game. Okay, so this is why, you know, sometimes people say, hey, I'm building a Boggle game, right? Zillion Boggle games out there, like we know how Boggle works. But you, by thinking really hard about what you built, there's no reason you can't make the next Boggle game that's the equivalent of Angry Birds, right? It's just that you have to figure out, what do I do that makes, that takes some of the properties that I really want, okay? The exploration, the creativity, the sort of mystery, what does this bird do? Okay, now I wanna keep playing because I got this new bird and I wanna figure out what it does, right? These types of things you can build into an existing app, even something that we're very familiar with, like a game like Boggle, doesn't mean that you can't innovate in the way that they innovated here. Before Angry Birds, there were plenty of catapult games. Angry Birds is Angry Birds because it does a variety of things really well. What else with the birds? Other things with the birds? Yeah. Right, so there's a combination of leveling up. There's levels and you can level up and to get to the next level, which is clearly visible. It's visible that there's other levels, but you don't know what they are. So there's a curiosity factor there that they've built in. And then, but then you're also curious, once you figure out that there's one bird and now there can be other birds, then that's another form of leveling essentially, right? Because now I'm kind of curious, well, what other types of birds are there gonna be? Are there going to be eagles? Like how often do the birds keep going? And if you played Angry Birds for any length of time, you know that you did this, right? At some point you said, oh, there's more birds. So I wonder if I keep going up levels, how complicated the birds are going to get, right? So what they have is at several different levels, they have things going on that are keeping your curiosity going. But implementing them, it's all actually, the implementation of it is relatively simple. It's essentially a physics engine with some cute graphics, right? But the way that they do it makes it special, okay? So this is what we're gonna be aiming for in your projects. Little things can make a big difference in terms of the way that your project comes together or doesn't come together. Okay, so let's go through a little bit here. So what do we have? We have a simple yet an engaging interaction. It's not procedurally simple, okay? It's the mental model is simple and then it progresses, all right? So the first user experience is mentioned in the article. What's your first experience? You have this bird, you basically don't know what to do. You're gonna put your finger on there and touch something and the bird's gonna fly out. And then you immediately realize, oh, I can stretch this thing and I can shoot the bird. And now everybody understands a slingshot, and so there's something you understand right away. Now I can shoot the bird, okay? All right, so I didn't have to learn anything. There was no tutorial, there was no instruction set. Last semester I'm begging with teams all the time. If you need instructions, rethink, okay? Try to build something that doesn't need instructions. How often do you all read instructions? Not very often, right? You're gonna try it, and then you're only gonna read instructions as a last resort, especially on a mobile app, but even with other things, right? And just because you're techies doesn't mean that other people don't do the same thing they do. In fact, at this point, if they try it and they can't figure it out without instructions, they probably just quit and move on to something else. It doesn't need instructions. Okay, so why is it that when then people propose their project ideas, they have all these instructions? Okay, don't propose projects. Like, figure out a way to get rid of the instructions by designing the game really carefully. Okay, so they did that here. It's really simple at the beginning. There's basically nothing you can do other than figure out by chance that I can launch this bird. And then at that point, you know, I'm going to figure out, wow, okay, now I can figure out on my own how to get the bird to fly over in the direction that I need it to be. Okay? And in fact, they do something really clever, which is, let's see if there's any chalk here. So on the first screens, on the very, very first screen of Angry Birds, essentially, here's the bird, and then here's the building. And I think the building, if my memory is correct, is very simple, too. There's not much to it, okay? Nothing to sort of set you off. And so almost anything that you do, it's all on the same screen. I just flick my finger on this, and almost anything I do is going to send a bird somewhere in the general vicinity. And then usually after one or two, I can probably figure out I hit this. And then I see, oh, okay, now it's knocking stuff down. I get it. I understand it. So there were no instructions, no anything. But now I can start increasing my skill. Okay? And then what they do is I start off with a really simple little house thing. And then it gets sort of increasingly complicated here, right? So I'm building up a skill set. Uh-oh. Uh-oh. Sorry. Do you guys have this room? No.
No.
Oh, okay.
Given the tour, you were surprised to see somebody.
Oh, it's a makeup thing, yeah. Yeah, okay. That was close. They're just giving a tour. All right. So what they do is they make this thing more and more complicated. So you're increasing your skill level now just by trying things out. Then what do they do eventually? If you remember, what they then do is they then increase so now I've constructed this schema, right? I understand how this game works. And now what they do is they increase the challenge, but in a very logical, natural way. So now what I have is my virtual play thing is like this. So when you play Angry Birds now, what you see is it starts here, and then it pans back over here. OK, now what did I just do? Huh? So now, right, I need my short-term memory to remember what was even over here. And my skill has to become even more adept, because now I've got to lobbing things where I can't even see the building, right? So they took a very simple change, you know, making this a distance. But they also, very deliberately, they don't just shrink this thing down so you can see everything and make it a bigger distance. They actually add something that's very explicit that requires a certain amount of short-term memory that makes the game, in many ways, you know, much more interesting. Can you zoom out? Yeah, if you watch people play them, almost like people won't do that for a while. Yeah. So that would be a good case where you can then make a deliberate decision, right? Do I want to allow people to do that or not? And what you may do at some point is say, for a real expert, now maybe I want to let them do that. So the other important thing is that the article points out, right, is that let's say I lob this thing over here. Okay, what's this about? Huh? Yeah, it's the trace or the trajectory. So what's the significance of that? Yeah, so it's not just a visual effect. It's like now I can actually improve my performance. Okay, without this game would be much more frustrating to play. Much more frustrating to play. This is really critical. Okay, so you could say, you know, if I built this game without this thing, you know, it might seem like everything might be almost identical, and it wouldn't be nearly as much fun. The minute that you add this little trajectory in, it becomes much more playable and more fun, because now I can incrementally make improvements that I couldn't do before. Little change, not much programming, right? By the time you've got all this 2D graphics already, I mean, you know, adding this little dotted line thing is not going to be a big deal. But the game experience just went from okay to really great, right? Small little change. And so what the beauty of this game is that there's all this thing, all these things in there to maintain engagement over time. So in the article it says, it's a carefully scripted expansion of the user's mental model of the strategy component and incrementally increases in the problem and solution methodology. Okay, so an example of this is the bird traits. They get more, start simple, get more complicated. The physics, start simple, gets more complicated. The miscellaneous stuff in the scene, right? They start off and they're just the pigs, and then eventually you've got pigs and crates that explode, and the whole 2D graphics, the 2D physics that it relies on gets more and more complicated. And so it's this idea that the user has a mental model of what they understand, or in some cases, if it's not a game, it might be what they want to do. And then you've understood what that is, and then you're building on that in a very incremental way. This is how you create a really good user interface. Okay? So new versions add even other stuff. So there's, you know, like, I think I haven't played any of the, I've only played the original one, but I mean, they have the birds in space or whatever and all these other things, right, that add sort of other types of stuff. They just keep building on this general model, and it works pretty well for what they want to do. So, use of timing and pacing. Faster is not always better, okay? In this case, a fast response time would actually make the game less fun. There's something about the nature of the way that the pacing of the game, you lob the bird, right, and then it hits the building, and then there's this whole thing where you just kind of watch it. What are you doing when that's happening? You're thinking. Hopefully you're always thinking, but you're thinking about what to do next, and you're thinking about what worked and what didn't work. You're planning for what you do next. How would it be different if you lobbed it over and it took basically 1 second and it was done? How would the experience be different? What would happen when I went back over here again? Am I going to be more or less deliberate in terms of how I do it? I'm going to actually be less deliberate. I'm going to be less deliberate if it's fast, more deliberate if it's slow. Because all that time when I'm sitting there watching this thing collapse, not only is it entertaining, right, some of the time, because there's a certain little bit of randomness in there and stuff, but I'm thinking, well, okay, if I hit it there, this might work. If I hit it there, this might work. I'm spending more time thinking about how to get it to work. That time I spend then influences what I do when I go over here. If it just collapsed or blew up right away, like in a first-person shooter, you know, then I don't even think about what I'm doing next, right? It's like, okay, I'm just going to go shoot it again and see if I can get it to do it better. So the timing is really important, as are the flight path and the slow pigs, okay, because we have error correction. So letting people correct their mistakes is a key user interface thing. And they can relax and think. The pacing is really important. So it doesn't, you know, going from slow to fast might be a good thing to do. If it's just fast all the time, people can't tolerate it. There's a limit to how long they can do it. But if it's slow and then fast and then slow and then fast, it's got a dynamic pacing to it, it may work a lot better. So fast is good and clever is better, I think is a quote from the paper, which I really like. Clever gets you a very long way. Okay? We have clever pig houses. They're curious, funny, topical. They're not hard to make. You could make, once you had your little, you know, design, however you're going to, you know, put these together, you could make lots of houses very, you know, it's not trivial to make those because you got to figure out how are things going to fall. But it's essentially the same strategy all the time, over and over again. But they, you know, some of them are shaped like hearts and some of them are shaped like things. And that little bit of cleverness goes a long way because we are naturally curious people. Right, or animals, and we, you know, if we think, oh, we like that, right, it makes you smile. It's not insignificant, and you don't have to be a designer to do this stuff. You know, the pigs are cute and the graphics are nice, but the game would be just as much fun if the graphics weren't quite as nice, right? They go a long way with some actually relatively simple sounds. They get a pretty long way, and you know, this game is not about fancy graphics. It's not what makes it great. So you don't have to be a graphic designer to make a great app for this course. What you need to think about is the user experience and the design of the app. Small variations dramatically change the complexity of the game. There's a simple storyline in between the level transition, which is also curious and kind of funny. It's like when you first start playing the game, you're like, why are there birds and why are there pigs? Why did the pigs hate the birds? You know, the whole thing. And it's not a complicated story. It's just a simple little story, but it's enough to make you think, why is this here? What's going on? And then there's action when new pig houses are introduced. So this is activating the short-term memory challenge that we talked about. Many addictive games have some sort of short-term memory component. I find in the class this is underutilized, I think, when people are thinking about apps that they're going to make. You want to bend but not break short-term memory. So again, with any game design, the issue is going to be getting the right balance between the challenge and the reward or the complexity. If it's too hard, it's no fun. If it's too easy, it's no fun, right? So what you want is something that's dynamically adapting so that it stays fun. And what they got right here is that it starts off and you don't need to know anything and you can start playing right away. And it gets increasingly challenging. And even my 7-year-old daughter can play this game forever and learn it on her own. Never had to be told anything and can play this game. And that's true of almost any of the really good apps out there. And she's had that reaction to some of the apps in the class. Actually, there's one from last semester that she's begging me to play all the time now on my phone. And it's one of the better designed apps from the course last semester. It doesn't require instructions. You don't have to read to play it and all this. You just kind of start playing. And that's the way Angry Birds was. All right, so there's mystery. There's some amount of conceptual depth. Why did they do that? Versus what were they thinking? So a lot of times when you try apps, you're like, why did they do it this way? What you want them to be saying is why did they do that in the app? I want to know. I want to understand. I want to keep playing. Examples are the tiny bananas, the background and the background and the ground in the Angry Birds. Sort of what you see there is some interesting stuff in the background sometimes. The strange home designs, birds and pigs, why birds and pigs, what will happen, the new birds and pigs. So all that stuff creates curiosity. And then the sound actually makes the game more addictive. So if you play it without the sound, you'll find that it's just slightly less engaging for whatever reason. And the sound's not really complicated. It's just a relatively small set of sounds that they play over and over again. But it's giving you a sense, the characters are taunting, so the pigs are sort of grunting and taunting kind of sounds. But there's a sense of off-screen action, so a sense that something is happening somewhere else is a very powerful force, even in a silly little simple game like this. Okay? So when you play a game like Words with Friends, the reason people get addicted to checking that is because, or the reason you even check your text messaging all the time is because you can't help yourself. Like if you think there's something new and interesting that you're not aware of, it's human nature. You want to find out what it is. You want to know what it's about. And so build apps that take advantage of that, right? That those are the ones that people keep playing over and over again. And even if it's just pigs off on the side that you can't see taunting you, you're still kind of curious. It's still there. It's still like, what are those pigs doing, right? So the background sound essentially builds tension, but it's not overbearing. It's not like music. They have their music, but it's mostly these sounds that kind of are background nature sounds that just kind of create a certain amount of suspense or tension, I think. The visual design, they talk about a hygiene factor. So if it's really it's a negative if it's missing, but a really good visual design is not going to overcome bad interaction design. Okay, so you can be a great artist and have a lousy interface, and there are plenty of those out on the app stores. They look great, but they're lousy. The design is lousy. The interaction design is lousy. So you start with the interaction design, keep the graphics and all that stuff simple, the sounds simple. You need the interaction design to be good first. You can always get a graphic designer after the fact who can help you make the graphics and visuals look better and the sound look better. But if the interaction design is not good in the first place, don't bother. There's no point. You've got simultaneously levels of challenge. So you've got your current bird, you've got sets of birds, you've got levels, then you've got levels of reward. Individual pigs, helmeted pigs, sort of spectacular building collapses that are sort of like a hole-in-one type of thing, right? And then completion of levels. So you've got multiple levels of rewards. That's another thing you want to try to get into apps that you design. So unpredictability is an interesting thing, okay? So unexplained randomness is going to irritate a user, no question, all right? If I use your app and one time I press the button and it does one thing, and the next time I press the button and it does another thing, I'm going to get irritated with it. That's even true for crashing. I mean, it's almost better if it consistently crashes versus it crashes only 50% of the time. It's more annoying that it's crashing 50% of the time, right? If it crashed every time, I would just probably not use it. If it crashes 50% of the time, I may have entered a bunch of information and then it crashed, and now I'm even madder at it, right? So unexplained randomness will irritate the user, but randomness can make things much more interesting. Okay, where do we get randomness in things like Words with Friends? I'll give you a hint. Words with friends. Who's providing the randomness? The friends, right? You know, your friends are going to do all sorts of random stuff that you can't quite predict, right? Most good games have some source of randomness that the user can explain. What's the randomness in Angry Birds?
The way that they collapse.
The 2D physics, okay? So there's randomness in that. It doesn't always behave exactly the same way. It's mostly right? But a small change, you'll accept it because you'll say, oh, that was just, we know that when things fall over, wind and other things can have an impact. So we accept the randomness in here. We don't even think about it. But there's randomness in this game and the way that the building falls down. So physics is a plausible way to introduce randomness, and it's not a coincidence that many games use physics pretty heavily because they get that sort of randomness in a reasonable way. Okay, other games get randomness by making AI characters that behave in a certain way, but if they don't behave in sometimes it's really hard to get that right because if you start suspecting that they're doing something that's not reasonable, you'll get irritated with the interface. Okay? So taking advantage of this is important. So there are more breakdowns on Angry Birds. I would encourage a couple other articles. I encourage you to read these all. These some of them are just, they're fun. They're thinking about why do people play these games. So I would encourage you to look at these supplemental readings. So how do you get a good idea? What's that? Many ideas, yeah. So that's what we're doing with assignment two. We want many ideas. So what you're going to do is you're going to do a cognitive teardown like what they do in that paper for Angry Birds. And you're going to pick one idea, and you're going to do half a page of sort of a cognitive teardown of some other game other than Angry Birds. And then you're going to take your idea or try to come up with an idea that's sort of merging those two. So we're trying to put a square peg in a round hole because sometimes doing that can help you come up with new good ideas. Then you're going to pick three project topic areas, and for each of those generate two ideas, okay? And you're limited to a half a page for each. You can use whatever you want to describe the idea. It can be sketches, it can be text, I don't care. You just have to describe the idea, okay? And say why it's a good idea. So at the end of the day, you're coming up with a whole bunch of ideas for this next assignment. And the goal here is coming up with a bunch of ideas that are as different as possible, from all the other ideas that other people come up with. And when we go through them, we're going to be looking at them and saying, of these ideas, these two or three seem like the most promising. Focus in this area. Right? So you're not going to get a good idea for your project unless you start now and start coming up with a lot of good ideas. And that's what this assignment is about, simply that. Okay? So if you have a question, like how detailed does it have to be? How do I describe the idea? It's up to you. You can do it however you want. Okay? You're limited to a half a page. You cannot go over half a page. So whatever fits in there. But if you want little screen sketches, I don't care what it is. Just but if somebody describes a good idea to you and you hear it, you know it. You say, "Oh, that's a good idea." Right? They can describe it to you in 30 seconds or less, and you'll say, "Oh, that sounds like a pretty good idea." We're looking for that, right? We want people to react to it in that positive way. So that's what the assignment is about, is just doing that. And you know, you're not committed to any of these ideas. And a final, you know, you may end up with none of these ideas as your final project. But if you don't start coming up with ideas, you're not going to come up with really good ideas. So that's what we're doing here. So hopefully it's a fun assignment. So are there any questions about it? Yeah.
In the idea number 2, which is the top of the first page, do we have to extend the idea that we have considered in the first half?
What I want you to do is take the game, right, that you picked, try to do this sort of tear down. What makes that game fundamentally work, right? And don't just say, you know, it's good graphics, right? That's not it, right? What is it, like in the Angry Birds, what are the things, like is it, there's a cognitive model that starts easy, you can build on it, and here's how they build on it. Do something like, right? And then you say, these are the things that make that game interesting. Then take some idea that you have and try to merge it with that, okay? So I understand this is a very open-ended task. I'm asking you to take one idea and another idea and merge them two together. Merge the two together. And
it has to be different than the other three ideas that you're going to be.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I want all the ideas should be different throughout the assignment. At the end of it, I think you actually come up with I think you're coming up with 10 ideas. Yeah. Right. 10 ideas. Okay? So, or, you know, optimally all 10 would be great. So, you know, and they should be 10 relatively different ideas, right? So one way, which the assignment says, to try to come up with ideas is to take something that you know is a good idea and take something else that you think might be a good idea and merge the two together, okay? So I'll give you a concrete example. You take something like Tetris. Boy, lots of games of Tetris out there. Who's confident they could come up with a game of Tetris that's better than all the other games out there? Now, that would be hard to say, right? Boggle. Lots of Boggle games out there. So it's hard to come up with a brand new Boggle game. But there's a really cool game called Drop Words, which is a combination of Tetris and Boggle. That's all it is. That basically describes the idea. Combine Tetris and Boggle together. And it's very fun to play. It's a unique idea. And so, you know, it's not quite Boggle, it's not quite Tetris. It literally is a merger of those two ideas. And it's a very nice game that's available on the Android App Store. So you should check it out. So I'm trying to get you to do that, right? Find things that you think are really great, right? And then say, all right, now I want to take a totally different idea and merge these two together, because that's how you're going to get your brain kind of in this mode of thinking out of the box, right? Thinking of things that other people haven't thought of. It's work to do this. You have to work at this. People don't just, you know, I mean, sometimes you'll sit up right and say, hey, I have a great idea. You know, but most of the time you have ideas because you're talking, you know, you're having a conversation about one thing with somebody and you go to somebody else and you're in the midst of doing something else and you say, oh, okay, I can put these two things together. And that's a new way of thinking about it. I hadn't thought about that. So this is an exercise to try to help you to do that. You can get yourself to do that. You don't just have to wait for it to happen. And the very act of generating 10 ideas is doing that as well, right? You may at this point have, you know, 3 or 4 ideas you think sound like reasonable project ideas. But as you start to try to force yourself to think of more, that's going to help you sort of get out of the whatever rut you might be in terms of how you're thinking about ideas. Okay? Any other questions on this? Yeah?
As you said that we can use any computer tools to create the sketches, right? We can use hand-drawn sketches, but on the pages, we can actually type it in, right? Or we can write it on paper.
Whatever you want. Yeah, I mean, if typing's easier to read, I'd prefer typing if it's text. But, you know, do whatever you want. I'm not constraining you. I have no expectations of fancy computer renderings or anything like that. I mean, sketches are perfectly fine. The idea is you're getting an idea down. You're not fleshing out all the details of the idea. It's just the idea. So don't go crazy and start doing, you know, 3D renderings and all this. I mean, that's not at all what I'm looking for here. I'm looking for a half-page description that gets an idea across. So you can do that however you want. It's about the idea and, you know, sort of conveying it in a reasonable way. It's not about the fanciness of rendering stuff or anything like that.
Yeah. Consider other game that in the list, which is SQL Editor.
Yeah, you have. Well, yeah, you have to. I think I say don't use Angry Birds.
Except Angry Birds, right?
Yeah. Yeah, okay, well, pick whatever. You could try another one or whatever. If you try one you've never played, and you come at it with this perspective of what's making it good, you know, you might be thinking of new things. It's up to you, though. I don't care what the game is you pick, as long as it's, you know, sort of one of those ones that would be generally accepted as an addictive sort of game. Okay? And I should say, your ideas are not, I'm not saying your ideas need to be games, okay? But if you're creating something that's, for one of the categories, you're creating something that's trying to think of one, like medication adherence, okay? That's not something that people think about as very fun or game-like, but you can still make something that's useful for people that has game-like qualities to it. So it doesn't have to be a game just for a game. In fact, most of them are not in the project list, but it can have game-like qualities to it, and that's what we're looking for, okay? So for the moment, just assume that they're small sensors. Unfortunately, I don't have any with me right now. They're about this big. You can wear them on different parts of your body, and they send data in real time to the phone about acceleration, which is change in velocity. Accelerometers. That's it. Yeah, that's it. And the phone, inside the phone, you have an accelerometer, you typically have a gyroscope, you have kind of a crummy light sensor, you have, so, you know, for the moment, don't get too caught up in the sensing. If you have specific questions, you can post on Piazza, and we can try to answer, you know, what is this sensor capable of. For the walk, it's just to assume you could put a sensor on somebody's limbs, for example, and get some information about how they're moving. You're probably not going to have information about the exact orientation of their limbs. Okay, it's just change in motion. That's what you get. Okay? Okay, so there's just a couple minutes here at the very end. I'm going to skip this discussion here. Okay. And just one last thing on a presentation tip. So last time I was here, we had actually three really great presentations given the limited amount of time people had to do them. The only thing I wanted to highlight from them, make sure you're teaching us the most important stuff. So part of your task is figuring out what's the most important. There's too much stuff in most of the articles to cram it all into a 6-minute presentation. Just try to, you're highlighting what we most need to learn, and make sure you give yourself time to take a few breaths. So, you know, again, don't try to just cram everything in. Think about how you're gonna structure what we need to take away from it. Okay, so I wanted to mention that. And then for next time, so assignment 2, sign up for the presentation topic if you haven't already, and the readings, and then be starting on assignment 4. Okay? So with that, I think we'll end for today. And then unless there's other questions, we're good? Okay, well, thanks for coming in on the holiday. And I hope it was helpful to you. It was definitely helpful for me.